Just got a free coffee with my EarnIFI points.
Your what?
The points I get with the new EarnIFI app from BP and Amoco. I got 250 for signing up and more every time I fill up or buy anything in the C-store.
Oh, can you use points for fuel?
Of course.
And discounts and deals?
On anything.
Oh, like chips?
Mm-hmm.
Sodas?
You got it.
The actual slushy machine.
Only what's actually for sale. But you do get double the points for the first 90 days. Just go to EarnIFIRewards.com to download the app.
Available at participating locations only. App content is subject to change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, October 18th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to talk really quickly about a new movie called We Live in Time, and then present an interview with that film's director, John Crowley. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and it's just me on today's episode. I just wanted to set up this film a little bit, and then we'll just jump right into my interview for a majority of this episode. So when word came out that Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield, two of the best actors of their generations, would be co-starring in a romantic drama distributed by A24, directed by the filmmaker behind the 2015 romantic film Brooklyn, I basically reenacted the Vince McMahon meme in real time because of how much the combination of those elements falls squarely within my personal set of interests. And the result is We Live in Time, this really wonderful, intimate, small-scale relationship drama that features just absolutely terrific performances and is exactly the type of stripped down human story that I think has fallen somewhat out of fashion as Hollywood has evolved into its current state. So I recently had the opportunity to speak with Crowley about the way that this movie jumps through time, finding the film's musical identity, which I think is an undersung aspect of this film, the most challenging scene to get right, and working with the mega-talented duo of Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield. And Crowley previously directed Garfield in the actor's first feature film, which was called Boy A, and it came out way back in 2007. So he also gets into some nice memories of that experience and how Garfield has evolved as a performer between then and now. This is not the type of movie that has like wild plot twists or anything like that, but this conversation does contain some spoilers for stuff that happens in the film. So if you want to go in completely cold, I totally understand that. I would recommend just watching the movie because it's great and then coming back and checking out this conversation. So I think the best thing to do here is just to take a quick break and then we'll come back and I will present my full interview, unbroken, with director John Crowley. So I rewatched Brooklyn because I knew that I would be speaking with you, and I loved it when it came out, and I loved it all over again on rewatch. And that movie is obviously a whole different thing than We Live in Time, but they both have this really lovely, quiet romance at the center of them. And I was wondering if you learned any lessons from Brooklyn that you were able to incorporate into this movie.
First time I've been asked that. Lessons. I don't know that necessarily lessons as much as they perhaps are both made from a wish to not simply capture romance in the film, right? Which is another way to answer your question. What I mean is the romantic elements that some people really cherish in both films are a very happy side effect of the story that I was telling. And you know, you're inviting that stuff along, but it's not what the film's about. And it's not consciously played by the actors. The actors are playing, hitting their obstacles, and they're playing, forming a life and falling in love with each other. And I think that an audience is getting a degree of this swoon and yearning that is around that, because it's been in both cases very truthfully played. So I would say it's just an instinct in both instances to try and play the heart of the material. But neither film shies away from emotion, it's true, you know, and tries to steer clear of sentiment as well as sentimentality or of a sort of cheaper schmaltzy emotion. But I have absolutely no problem with heartfelt emotion in films, and I have no time for the idea that it's sort of not cool or something, or that it's a bit, you know, unfashionable to kind of go wear your heart on your sleeve. And I think that it's one of the great things about film. If it's truthful, it can really move a huge number of people, you know. So
yeah, you say that romance is not what the movie is about. Do you feel comfortable going on record or saying what you think the movie is about, or are you one of those
yeah
Okay. Yeah. Well, no, of course. I'm curious what you think.
I think it's a film about two people trying to answer the question meaningfully, which is what is a meaningful life in the face of a foreshortened life? If you are tapped on the shoulder and told, well, this big horizon that you thought you were having, which is perhaps the case in Brooklyn, right, which is they're just living their life. Well, her complication is the pull of home and what the kind of the second life, the ghost life she could have had, or she's haunted by this split. In this instance, it's more, you know, they're busy making their life and getting on with it together. And they're told, well, sorry, but it could be 12 months, it could be 6 months. And you know, within that, that's one thing. That is a melodramatic effect, or as an event, is one thing. The film is asking, what's the best way to spend the time? You know, which is what's a good life, really? And so that's a result. It's not, that's that question, posing that question, which is posed 10 minutes into the film in the big scene between the pair of them in the underground car park, is not necessarily the stuff that you would think would invite in waves of romance. But of course it does, because actually they are two people who then proceed to sort of squeeze a lot of joy out of life. And when you see the aspects of the relationship, the complication of the relationship and all the facets, which is what the time jumps allow us to do, I think you feel that you have a complete portrait of a marriage by the end of it.
100%. I was actually going to ask you about the time jumping element. I was wondering if you stuck to the script the whole way through, or was there a moment where you said, you know what, it might be more interesting to actually jump through time to this moment after this scene instead? Were you able to play at all with that in post or anything?
Played a lot. I mean, you know, the script already had a beginning, middle and end, as they say, as Godard said, but not in that order. It was already shuffled, right? And then we shuffled it all the way around again. So it was broken apart and put onto the floor in the editing room and reassembled bit by bit. So the scene that was at the start is no longer at the start. It's three quarters of the way through. The very last scene of the film is no longer the last scene of the film. Literally, it just was, we I don't always say we started from scratch. There are linear, you know, there's three storylines running and they do have a forward traction in them. But the task became about, with those performances and you know, how to make each scene speak to the one that's next to it in a way that was more visually eloquent and cinematically exciting, in a way that we had to leave the script behind, because the script did its own thing really beautifully. It was a wonderful blueprint and gave us all the pieces of this mosaic, but we then had to shuffle them and refine the logic for the film.
It seems like the music is extremely important in a movie like this, especially in those montage sequences where we're kind of seeing the relationship bloom and progress. And I was wondering what your approach was to working with Bryce Dessner on the score here and getting what you needed for those moments. I was kind of finding myself thinking, like watching the film and thinking about what those sort of montage-y scenes might be like without music, and thinking, that's a simple thing to say, but obviously the vibe would be completely different without music. So just for a film like this and sort of the connective tissue of the scenes that you're working for, what do you need musically for a movie like this?
Well, it took us a long time to find the musical identity, you know, is the simple truth. And before I met Bryce, for the first, you know, probably the first 12 weeks of the edit, I had a music supervisor who was trying lots of different pieces of music on all of these sequences in order for me to sort of define kind of what I was looking for, really. And it was hard, because you put the wrong piece of music on this film and it screams out. It's horrifying. It's awful. It suddenly makes it lesser, and it makes it a different kind of film. It would squeeze it into kind of a kind of rom-com, or a kind of, I don't know. It was turning into all these kind of non-films. So it was almost like a via negativa. It was like, well, I know that it's not that. It's not that. It's not that. It's not that. I met Bryce and was a huge admirer. Loved The National, of course, but also a huge admirer of his score work and of his classical work, which is a different sort of strand to what he does. And he had a very, very strong visceral reaction to the film, and he loved it. And it was palpable, and he was excited about the possibilities of what the score could bring to it. It's just, he didn't talk a great score then. He didn't necessarily go, and it should be this. It was sort of like, it could be this, it could be that, you know, and I love that. I love the fact that he was willing to then start and go on the journey. He sent me a huge amount of music in quite a short period, which is sort of his response, or responses, to the film. He didn't start on the first, you know, scene and go, this is the first piece of music for the first scene. So it became about then trying, like almost like these pieces of music on this lattice work, as it were, trying to see, okay, that goes there, that goes there. And about, I don't know, maybe 4 weeks into that process, the piece that emerged, which didn't have a huge number of champions in those around me, like in the editing room, and which is the main sort of love theme, which is it's the one at the very start, and it's the one that has when they're at the back to back in the doorway leading to that montage, and then the very end with the breaking of the eggs. And I thought it was an exquisite melody and quite an unusual melody. But the way the original piece was, it didn't sit on the film very well. It was a little bit too sad almost. It was quite a melancholy, dark piece of music almost. So, but it sat between a sort of happy place and a sad place, the actual notes. It felt like it was doing the two of those things at the exact same time in a way that I thought was exquisite. So I asked him to rework it, and he did. And he did various different versions of it at different scales. And then that began to emerge as a beautiful sort of like 3-point spine for it. And then other pieces, he noodled, he played, he came to London. We, you know, we sat together in front of the film. He got out the guitar and sometimes he would play along to try and see, is that the vibe and get that. And then sometimes on some of the more, you know, abstract pieces where it was, look, I think we need to go beneath melody. It needs to be almost more ambient here. He did a bunch of that in the room as well, and then took it away, and then took those ideas and made it, which was just sort of, you know, blocks of chords moving into each other, but allowing the space for the emotion in a scene to sort of shimmer. So that was the sort of process. It was incredibly rich and happy and playful. And then you come to Air Studios and watch it being recorded, which is always the biggest thrill in the filmmaking process, is to hear an orchestra bring it to life while watching those images. You know?
Yeah. So speaking of process, in a movie like this, when you're not dealing with tons of visual effects and the attention is more on relatable human drama between characters, what are the biggest challenges for you as a director? Is it knowing when to employ a close-up? Like, what kind of things keep you up at night during a production on a movie like this?
You don't have as many tricks in your bag to sort of hide behind. So if something's not truthful, right, something's not clear, and you can't make it clearer, you know, you're exposed, as it were, you know. And it especially in a film which is structured in this way, which is jumping around in time, and you want that, I wanted that to feel fluid. And for the first 10 minutes, maybe for an audience to go, what's the story with this? And you can feel the uncertainty, and then it settles down for it to begin to reveal that there is a form and a structure to the unfurling of events. And that by for the last sort of 25 minutes or so, you're just fluidly flowing between different realities. That was the intention. It took a long time to get there. So while you're not there, you're not anywhere. You are in a space of running into roadblocks and two scenes that won't sit together very well, and, you know, a chunk of information and that doesn't. And of course, you know, you're running three time frames against each other, one of which is ostensibly like from the very first point that they meet to the point that they say goodbye, which is kind of 5 years overall. One of which is the year of her second diagnosis, right, which is through the cooking competition, and one of which is the day of the birth. So you've got these three different time frames running against each other that have different paces. And the day of the birth is all about waiting. So you can have these big lurches of plot, and then suddenly you go back to a scene where nothing's happening. Well, that scene is going to look like it's demanding to be cut, because it's like nothing's happening. So that took a lot of work to know how to almost educate an audience very quickly as to how to accept a scene in which people just sit in the bath eating Jaffa cakes as a scene and enjoy that for itself, and that is the point of it and the purpose of it. Music helped with that, placement of it helped, and a certain kind of confidence of like, no, this is what this day is about. And it's so subtly making a viewer aware that you can be in on the joke with this, because then suddenly they're out of time and they're in a petrol station in Croydon in South London and it's game over, you know. So.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Can you put your finger on a scene that was the hardest to get right for you? Something that just was not working, but you eventually were able to figure it out?
You mean in the edit or on the shooting?
I guess during shooting.
Oh boy, that's a tough one. I mean, I don't know that there was one that was. I mean, look, there were some huge technical issues with like the ice was very difficult, because every time you want to go for another take, you're walking on ice crampons onto the ice to talk. I mean, the actual reality of shooting a sequence like that, which is not a very long sequence, but on ice with actors who don't skate, is challenging. It's just tough. So, but they were wonderful, and they kept the playfulness of what was needed up with that. And, you know, and everybody's moving on ice, and of course it goes wrong, it goes bad. You know, it's like you're shooting on water or something. You know, I would say the big birth scene was the biggest emotional. That was over 2 days, and there was so many elements in that. Technically, that we were obsessed with. We had a midwife on set. We had a prosthetic. We had, and then of course at the last minute, you introduced an actual real baby. I remember going into the shooting of that with my head like hot with the quantity of things that you are thinking could go wrong here, and you're trying to anticipate. And when we were about halfway through the scene, I could actually watch the scene and watch the material. I was like, oh my God, this is really special. This is what they're playing, and the way in which they're revealing the heart of what's going on in this scene, it's really working. It's yielding. That was thrilling. That was really exciting. Yeah.
I've never seen anything quite like that before. So you definitely pulled it off there. That was very impressive. I mean, Florence is amazing in this movie, especially in that scene, but she's asked to do so much and be so vulnerable here. I'm also curious about your reunion with Andrew Garfield. Like, tell me about reuniting with him all these years after Boy A, your first collaboration together. Has he changed as an actor at all?
Yes and no. I mean, he's the same creature in lots of ways. You know, when he was in doing Boy, it was the very start of his career, and it was his first leading role, and he was like a very scared boy in lots of ways. You know, he was 22, 23. Now he's playing a broken child. He was playing a damaged young creature, but there was a lot of fear in him and Andrew. He was this young man who was full of energy, but with a sort of degree of terror, I think, almost as if whether he was going to get the life he wanted or not, and the career he wanted, and there was no guarantees. That he wasn't Andrew Garfield yet, you know. He was just this kid who everybody was impressed by, but so he was able to use that sort of churn of emotion in the role in a way that was heartbreaking, and he was technically dazzling when he needed to be, when the chips were down on a shoot which had no time like that. I remember the last shot of the film, close up on his face when he's on that pier, and they were trying to kick us off the pier, and you know, the producer said, well, can we cut around it? Is there something else? And I was like, yes, the last shot of the film, what are you talking about? We can't cut around. And he just, you know, jumped up on an Apple box, pointed the camera, shot a take. It was dazzling. I pushed my luck and said, let's go for one more. He did two, and it was two bullseyes, boom, boom. And it's like, that's a very particular thing. When under that kind of pressure and stress, somebody can come and do something as emotional as that in close up. It was like, wow. And that was towards the end of the shoot. So I was already like, okay, this guy is really special. Now, you know, 17 years later, he's a man, right? And I don't, you know, he literally is, in the sense that he's so emotionally, he's matured and grown. And, but the creature that he was, that degree of intensity with the work has just grown in him, and his curiosity, and he still has a hunger to kind of get at the real work. He still is, there's a restlessness in him, and not a perfectionism, because perfectionism suggests that there is a perfect answer. It's more like he's really trying to get at something better behind the scene all the time, and not in a neurotic way, in a way that's really trying to just gently open it. So it's once again about giving him the space, literally, and clearing his eyeline in order for him to connect with a moment. And in this instance, connect with his fellow actor as well, because the connection between them is so profound. But you know, he was technically good when he was 23. Now he's sort of, I mean, he's dazzling. He's like an athlete in terms of what he can do physically, and his understanding of what he's doing. Well, he's got a huge raw emotional range to play with as well.
I think I probably have like a minute and a half left with you, but I did want to ask about Florence and like what kind of conversations you had with her before she signed on, because like I said, this is such an intimate role for her.
Mm. She's very direct, Florence. She was like, this is great. I love it. I want to do it. Yeah. It was very, very, in a weird way, it was like, really? And almost didn't trust that it could work out, because the first time we called about Florence, she was not available because of the Marvel movie. And then that slid back and she got 8 free weeks and she was in. And she was very keen to shave her head. That was in our first conversation. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Because I had assumed that an actor who was going off to do a huge superhero franchise movie would not, you know, shave it all off. But she was absolutely adamant about it, which is fantastic. And she has a sort of truth instinct. She's like a heat-seeking missile. She goes straight to the heart of something. She doesn't like to over-talk about it. She doesn't like to intellectualize. She doesn't want to, you know, she wants to do it, get on with it. She loved rehearsals with Andrew. And I think that allowed them both the space to find each other. We had 2 weeks rehearsal and to just sort of, and it helped that they really liked each other, which is great. And it just allowed them to study the map of the territory before they had to climb the mountain, as it were. You know, that they just understood what all these scenes were, so that under pressure on the day, they could really dial it up and go for it emotionally.
Yeah, they're both fantastic in it. I love the movie, and thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thanks,
again,
Ben.
I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk.
All right, I hope you all enjoyed that. I hope it enhanced your viewing experience in some way retroactively. But yeah, this is a great movie. Please spread the word. This is the kind of thing I want to see more of. Great actors just being in really grounded human stories. This is the kind of stuff that I grew up on, and it seems like a lot of this has been kind of shunted off to streaming in recent years. So I'm glad to see a movie like this get a big theatrical release. You can find more about We Live in Time, including the review for the movie, up on slashfilm.com. I will link to that in the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. I would love to get a bunch of emails from you all if you're still listening to this part. It's been so long since we've done like a full-on mailbag episode. So if you have anything that you want to know about, any thoughts about movies that came out this year, any lingering questions, anything like that, hit us up. bpearson@slashfilm.com is the email address, and maybe we could put together a big mailbag episode in the weeks to come. Please leave your name and general geographic location in those emails in case we mention yours on the air. Don't forget also to take a minute and rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That's really important. And then also, if you're still listening, I might as well just ask you, I say this at the end of every episode, tell your friends about the show any way you can. I would really love to increase the number of people who listen to the show so I can justify continuing to do it. So I'm serious. If there's anyone out there that you know that loves movies or TV or pop culture, any of the stuff that we talk about, and you listen to the show, and it might just be fun to send this to them, and you guys could have something to talk about. You can yell at us collectively or disagree with us, agree with us, whatever. That would just mean a lot to me if you could help spread the word about the show, post about it on social media, anything like that. Spread the word however organically you can. That would just really mean a ton. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for listening. And I hope you all have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat. Literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over 1 million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.